Welcome to another Poetica podcast from RN. I'm Justine Sloanlees. September this year saw the passing of poet, radio broadcaster and teacher Martin Harrison. As a tribute to Martin, we're replaying a two-part feature made in 2005 when he and fellow poet Sam Wagan Watson took to the road together to read and discuss their work. In this second program, they're still on the move, but making roadside stops in the bush, the city, and on the shoreline as they travel into the night. At the time, Sam had just won the New South Wales Premier's Literary Award for poetry. Here's On the Road, Part 2.
Crazy week this week for me. I'm going to be a nutcase by the end.
That's good.
The New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards have been announced in Sydney.
The book Smoke Encrypted Whispers by Brisbane-based poet Samuel Watson was announced as Book of the Year, and it also won the $15,000 Kenneth Slessor Prize for Poetry.
Shall we go to the night?
Yeah.
Shall we go night? Shall we go dark?
Yeah, let's go a bit dark. Night's coming. Night's coming. I'm going to write. I'm going to knock this thing over tonight. Yeah. How far into the night are we going to go, mate?
I go at night often into TV.
Oh, yeah, okay. I have to admit it. I'm shocking. I'm a Warner Brothers baby. I was addicted to the Roadrunner show when I was a kid. There was just something about that open freedom of all those backdrops where the Roadrunner and the Coyote ran that's fueled me through life. You know, just love of movement. Are we recording at the moment?
It is our policy to leave it going, but you can...
Cool. I reckon writers are better drivers than average people because we pre-analyse the scenes ahead. You know, for me, everything happens in a sequence and you look at the road ahead.
Yes.
You picture a lot more than, you know, than the average Joe who's just sort of... Whereas writers analyse the props, they analyse the backdrops, average people just sort of cruise through them.
Writers are not better pedestrians, though, than people, because, I mean, so many writers get knocked down on the street. It's true.
Yeah. The late shift erupts. Greek boys in turbo-fitted fours open the back streets of bitumen lines built for mice. A gear-crunching nightscape howl, simultaneously embraced and ejected into the dire congestion of the city's spectral pitch, like the fading trumpet oratorio of an emphysema-riddled jazz musician. Yeah, I've always got to have a little bit of night there.
Yes. Night's paddock. When we meet at night, this is what I feel. You are moving under dark trees. I am those trees, those shapes. You're the stars moving down the plain. You're the stars moving behind the motion of that move, the inwardness of mood by which stars and night modify their space inside a moving mark. A restless mark, a figure of moons, of present and absent moons, of darkness shining on the water tank, of dark motion at the edge of dark matter, holding it, cupping it, as if it's water glitter in the mind, or a single thread of memory, moving like a herd across the dust. My own night within me, miles of fences under the night, hovering.
I'm a Southside kid, Brisbane. I did a bit of growing up on the Sunshine Coast, but living back on the South Side and just a couple of streets away from where I was born, at 3 a.m. I have an immense sense of clarity, I suppose. I'm just penning some pieces now called Owl Songs, and we have owls at home, and they just do this whoo-hoo kind of thing at night. Mm. And it's weird, like the owl songs I'm working on, I think I explain one owl in the first pieces as like the roadie that's on the stage going 1-2, 1-2. Just the owl says to me, you know, it's like it's testing the sound. The sound moves beautifully through that darkness of 3 a.m. In Brisbane. You know, I can shut my eyes and almost imagine hearing like the breezes coming off the river coming in at that time. It's just so still and so, yeah, it's my time of the day. Revolver. From my balcony, I can read a strong poem that the moon has pasted on the river. Everything is quiet. Now and then a wave breaks the message, temporarily changing the font from bold to italics. The moon in its crescent appearance is the precision blade of a Shaolin warrior. I'm concerned that if I gaze too long, I may carelessly jag my retinas on its razor points, pierced globes adding vitreous humour into this serious stretch of river. A mullet leaps from the water and reconstructs the moon's message. It is now the sound of one silver hand clapping. Above, an anonymous comet breaches the sky a small eternity, but shooting stars don't have the recoil of a poem executed in the lull of moon fire. Oval mirror lights, seduction on night water, flagrant moon kisses.
Fine rain at night. Fine, very slow, persistent rain, with its undertalk of shimmerings and insect wings, has already got going, is already talking its half-heard voices round the back of the house or here along the veranda. It's drifting an arrowhead through the side door light. Now it's playing its late modern ensemble of pings and drum beats. It should be recorded, treated, made into a model of world music, a long-sought harmony between things and minds. It's played by no one, designed nowhere, part of the great limit on sciences, global structure, maths. It defies motive, it has function. It suggests how most events are random. Being mere rain, it keeps battering on gutters, down drainpipes. Being invisible, it saunters out of the darkness like an animal, padding up before you've seen it. Bright, noisy, definitely a body fanning out across the blackness, sliding through branches, but more like a face whose expression you'd like to read and know well. What you notice is Amazon rivers, lakes, shorelines, swamps. That's how your mind's flooded with it, adapting to its miniatures, which freefall on veranda post, wooden steps. It crowds night space. Not yet mapped, the gaps in it are like a clear night's stars.
Oh yeah, we're getting into the darkness. Fly fishing in Woolloongabba. Facing the mirror and having a shave in the near darkness after an evening of watching the wine disappear. Listening to traffic outside, rivers of exhausting light, white light upstream, red light downstream. Schools of syringes wade in the shallows, needle packets float in the gutter, absurd fish scales of the breeze. My partner understands it better. Better than most, understands the intersecting flow gently she understands. As a young girl living on a remote black community, a minority of her in a majority, she understands she is even too gentle for this river here. And back in the mirror again, a spot of blood appears on my face, the water running down the drain with my blood, night juice into the underside of the current on our doorstep. A small fire is ignited up the street. We hear the faint pop. When someone has lost it, tossed a chemical bomb on the steps of the Serbian church. And just what did it solve as they escaped down one of the side streets, down one of a thousand bitumen estuaries of the big river? When tomorrow I'll stand on the doorstep, cast out a line in the comfort of full contents insurance, the sharks motionless in the disguise of the undertow, and the little fish sighing for the want of better.
I think a lot of your work is very sort of close and at night, isn't it? It's very much in the work. It's very intense. It's kind of very. It is that space you're describing of clarity in the dark. Yeah,
Midnight's Plague, I call it. Midnight's Plague.
A dog barking. Some things are beyond talking. Not the mind, not emotions. Words will always come for them. Perhaps the mind lives in this barrier entirely of its own creating. You see it the way it is. It looks back the same. The fence, the lake, they're just there. Some things, though, can't be spoken. I don't mean sex or family strife, which fast enough have silent words, their looks black as emptiness through the kitchen door at night. Sex, anxiety, secrets. That's what stays hidden when the wife's still washing up from tea and her husband stomps off to bed. It's money, really, or too much work brings them down. While the thing which is beyond talking is beyond their strangeness too. What's left unsaid is mostly what is known. A dog barking, embers when the sun sets, a tree's late apples stained a deeper red. That, too, isn't much to say. The wording of anger, fearsomeness, family ghosts drowns the brain in its non-stop TV. Neurons buffer up like dodgem cars. Birds swoop down through invisible nets. But something, suddenly, must rescue you. The darkness of crickets trilling, shining. I find them quite hard to kind of get into the night, my own work. Occasionally I can write in the night, as it were.
Yeah, well, I have a bad habit of getting up at, say, 3 o'clock in the morning and just grabbing a drink of water and then writing.
So you write before dawn, in other words? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'll write a few pieces and then I'll try and knock some work over, and maybe around 7 or 8 o'clock I'll go back to bed for maybe an hour, then get up and edit.
Yes, I can sometimes kind of wake up with bits and pieces of poems, but I don't write in the middle of the night. I can't. I don't really do it. Actually, I work almost best at later in the day.
Yeah.
This is definitely kind of end of the day. This is definitely sunset territory. This is.
Yep.
Mile Lake is up the north coast of north of Sydney, a few hours north of Sydney. This is called Fire. The concrete boat ramp looks out across Mile Lake, where a patch of water's on fire again. Bright as a child-sized lens held over a leathery gum leaf, it slowly goes darker and darker, then suddenly ochre brown, before the first wisp, the first thin-tongued shoot, curls up and bursts into red glow. Spreading across from the west, all the water takes on that raging hearth, caught in mirrored cloud bars and widening ripples. Close to shore, a fish bites the surface, leaving its silver rings. Within minutes, the light's gone lemon, while mercury water turns to black. Winter suns end always in a flash. This one, though, now lights up a line of darker hills for campers arriving late, coping with their kids. Their voices drift in trees. Fireflies of torches track from tent to car. A Toyota's rear windows stare out, a final chrome in orange air. Someone's chopping wood. A lamp's pumped up. Beyond it, the ridge's dark lizard skin gets mottled with first stars, while quivering the surface, a last flame hovers like a burning raft.
Well, in response to that, I too have a piece called Fire. And I dedicated this piece to David Gilby. I've done two wonderful residencies out at Wagga Wagga. Fire. Fire engine flash of fox pelt and a plume of tail, fluffy, like some oil well ablaze on a Gulf War postcard. And from the body, it was fleeing at a 2 o'clock incline. Almost innocent in the ebb of dawn, above the vineyards at Baranga, sauntering erratically as a red beacon across the screen of a life support monitor. Up and down and away, this alien enigma upon Wiradjuri's skin. I must be away one weekend a month and hanging out with my peers, and we always seem to chill out over a good meal and we have a story about food, and I think a poet's cookbook would just be the ideal thing. Where all instead of us,
because recipe books actually have titles in big bold letters which look like prototypes, and then the actual text not that long, and a lot of it actually is in a kind of list, and it looks like lines, you see.
Yeah.
And so really we're very at home writing recipes.
Yeah.
It just feels the right kind of format.
Yeah. Well, and it sort of came up. I just did a gig with Robert Foster from the Go Betweens. It was funny, the whole time we talked about honey.
Honey?
Honey, yeah.
Stopping for a walk in reserved land near Maramara. It's a stopover on a spring day when, walking through the bush, I see them. Bees. Wild bees already clustered, already swarmed. A galaxy of living honey, they hang on a branch in a swollen brown gourd, a primitive shape caught on the move. All gouache, clay and bubble, it's hard to fix it for what it is. Frightening to imagine stumbling into its pelting dust, just landed out of the horizon's blue nowhere, now settling above dwarf tea tree, above red earth. Pummeled soil, hanging between sky and ground, it takes on a flickering gold-dyed sheen, gold as if a shock of tinted hairs been threaded, quartz-like, through its ochre mass. Bodies, heads, legs, writhing on each other, pinioned there. It's as if each body mimics a future cell, or as if the air has opened up a hasty wartime grave where corpses tossed into the pit drown each other with their awkward rotting limbs. This swarm is that exposed, that stark. A wattle and daub affair, compacted in a furious swerve to a taller tree's white branch, the swarm hangs there. Sandstorm brown, a haze of movement and molecules. It's as sharp and deafening as if all the body's sensations arrive at one go, or as if a lifetime's thoughts are suddenly, spontaneously recalled by someone moving at the very edge of life, when the mind's sky white with memories, swelling with the fruit of experience, swarming at death, yet holding all feelings together. Or as if, veil-like, it summed up later, generations later, after the earth has soaked up spilt blood and honey streams, by the philosopher who says, things are not things, but groups, sets, swarms, flux, playing their music of ant and bird. The swarm is light, its energy, fruit of the desert's edge. Fruit indeed is fruit. And whether in grief or orgy, these bodies pile on top of each other. They're a huge brown pear. They're an outsized bobbin of unwashed flax hanging from a yellow gum. It takes forever to focus on. It swirls. It implodes in the branches, hanging there like a wind harp of silk glitters and half-dried mud, with outriders taking off and returning like flies to a carcass. Not beautiful, dark, full of anger, full of sting, it changes shape like a pot spun between invisible hands, slowly growing bulbous, then tapering to a narrow neck, in danger of falling apart or attacking like a Mongol horde, yet still clustering, still forming itself from spring's exile and the struggle of poisoned virgin grubs, till it steadies its larval magic into an earth mother drone of particles, dynamos, ancestral flight.
For the wake and skeleton dance. The dreamtime Dostoevsky's murmur of a recession in the spirit world. They say the night creatures are feeling the pinch of growing disbelief and Western rationality, that the apparitions of black dingoes stalk the city night hungry. Their ectoplasm on the sidewalk in a cocktail of vomit and swill. Waiting outside the drinking holes of the living, preying on the dwindling souls fenced in by assimilation. The dreamtime Dostoevskys must ponder as dark riders in the sky signal a movement. For the wake and skeleton dance, it's payback time for the bureaucrats in black skins and the fratricide troopers before them. No room to move on a dead man's bed. Is it all worth holding on to these memories amidst the blood-drenched sands? It's maybe better to forget. The dreamtime Dostoevskys feel the early winter. Chilled footsteps walk across their backs in the dark hours. The white man didn't bring all the evil. Some of it was already here, gestating, laughing, intoxicated, untapped, harassing the living, welcoming the tall ship leviathans of 2 centuries ago that crossed the line drawn in the sand by the serpent, spilling dark horses from their bowels and something called the covenant, infecting the dreamtime with the ghosts of a million lost entities, merely faces now, and some big festival of the dead. The wake is over, and to the skeleton dance, the bone men smile. It's open season on this land for chaos theory and retirement eternal for the dreamtime Dostoevsky.
You'd have to have a sort of, in the cookbook, we'd have to have a sort of 20th century section, like Marinetti had all sorts of futurists, sorts of recipes. They had their sort of rose petals and chocolate recipes and those sorts of things. So we could have the history of poetic cooking.
Yes. Was there anything I could do?
I like that last piece you were reading, and I like the emotionality. I mean, I like that sense of the intensity of it. I think at some point, I think, you know, in a sense, authenticity is not the issue. I think in a way, directness is.
You know,
kind of getting the work out there, getting it engaged with what is actually sort of occurring in people's lives. Mm. What are the events of people's lives? Particularly in this very ideological period where so much untruth is floating around in the world.
Of course, of course. Yeah, I'm having a bit of a struggle at the moment. I've got this Black Poets Night on Friday night, and I've been trying to develop. I've been trying to develop a few pieces in response to like the Queensland government's policies on Murrays and Islanders, and I'm trying to get that directness, but at the same time, crazy week this week for me. I'm going to be a nutcase by the end of it.
That's good.
Going to be an absolute nutcase.
But maybe you can't, I mean, maybe none of us can head sort of straight into the storm. You can't take things head on. You know, you have to kind of go around all these incredibly big issues, you know.
Yeah. So I'm constantly concerned that I'm going to come off sounding like I'm preaching or,
Preaching in the sense of telling people off?
Yeah. I want to portray something, but I don't want to. Anyway, it'll come.
I think tell the story.
Yeah.
And everything that you want to say comes through it, basically.
Yeah.
And people will make the connections themselves.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise you end up sort of almost with too much pathos in the work.
Mm. I tell you, just now, this experience is probably the best reading I think I've ever, like the one reading that I'm comfortable with. We've got an audience of two people.
Well, there's an audience.
Just throwing back, don't have to look at a clock.
Yes.
You know, there's about three pieces I know now. If I went back to my hotel room with a notepad, three pieces I've been working on over the year, I could finish them today.
Could you? Yes.
Just because I suddenly feel like I've got a bit of clarity.
Yes.
Just hearing your voice and your work. I'm like, yeah, that could work. This can work. That can work. So, yeah.
I have a long poem at the back of my mind, and I've had it for like a month, and I cannot get. I've got all these words, and they're all over kind of stacks and stacks of pieces of paper.
Yeah.
And I cannot actually get this thing. I can see it. I can actually see it on the page. I can see the length of it.
Yeah.
I can see how it looks.
Oh, yeah. I've got a few of those. It's frustrating. You can see it, but you can't quite grab it.
No.
You can't touch it. The Dusk Sessions. The pyromaniacs of the gods were kicking it into that desert sunset upon a fire pink, burner blue horizon line. Blossoms cherry red and naked solar flares drowning into hibiscus hell flowers, dancing awake for the dying light above a necropolis of mulga and spinifex. Fueling until darkness when the tourists overdose on shooting stars, the lark of Min Min lights on the petals of midnight bloom, as the ghost riders take up watch. Illuminated into the pitch by the sun-bleached bones of dry spell roadkill.
You're back on the road, aren't you, at that point?
Back on the road, but touching darkness.
Yes.
A bit, yeah. Of course, we have to have a cocktail hour.
No.
He used to make these. He had an old urn. He used to make these alcoholic punch concoctions and bring it to readings. And he'd leave the urn in the boot of his car and serve these concoctions. They were just toxic out.
So we'd have the cocktail section at the back. And and we'd have a little sort of...
entree,
hors d'oeuvre. Hors d'oeuvre is the word we're going to have to work on,
course,
I think, actually. The oeuvre for us is going to be very important. Desserts. Now that's going to be the interesting one.
Oh, desserts. Sweet.
I think you ought to get painters to do
painters to dessert. They've got to look good, you mean.
I think Peter Goldsworthy's got a few chocolate palms. Chocolate.
chocolate.
We could have little sort of palate cleansers between courses, which we would call sonnets, of course.
Yes.
I always say when I'm asked to go into a class and talk to, and I hate it. I don't like the idea of creative writing courses at universities, because I believe writers aren't born in universities. They're born out in the suburbs. But RIP was one of those moments when I'm so glad I always have my journal and a pen with me, and it's for my little boy. Standing under the ex-wife's house, concrete pillars covered in the hieroglyphics of grubby little hands, hanging pieces of antique chairs that we had planned to restore together, armrests of that old couch, the old dining table that belonged in our first house, silent in this elephant's graveyard of carved husks. There are the spider legs of a hot plate that fed the guests at our little boy's naming ceremony, and suddenly I realise I'm caught. Gazing over the past, this ensemble of assorted relics, she's been busy under here, making the sander scream, the electric plane has been driving the kids nuts as she shaves the timber. The skins of furniture from one of my lives, golden curls of treated pine sit at the floor of the workbench. I remember reading Robert Adamson's poetry the day she called it quits. Over and over, I read the poems about a troubled little boy and his blonde mop of curls. I look down and my own little boy has found a pile of shavings, grabs a handful in his muffin fist, holds it at me, falling through his grasp, these curls. What are they, Daddy? They're pieces of my brain, I tell him. And he tosses his fist into the air. Particles swab us like pixie dust. The afternoon sun steals through, catches the golden flakes and my little boy's toothy grin. He wakes me before I drown in a tide of old regrets. Look here, Dad, I'm playing with your memories.
Should we read maybe a couple of things, just kind of which are like final pieces, as it were, ending pieces.
I get that
feeling. Like, what's one of your sort of a poem that sort of says kind of end in it, as it were? What's it kind of?
I know I've got an old favourite, an oldie bit of goodie.
Do you want to go first?
No.
Okay.
Please.
Whatever. I thought that what I might read is this. It's got a very sort of sense of an ending title. It's called Late Western Thought.
Okay.
You couldn't be more sort of final than that. You couldn't have more finality than the end of Western Thought. Okay. Mm-hmm. Here's the poem, Late Western Thought. They were top-knot pigeons whirring up from the edges of the driveway, getting lift off with their high-pitched wing beats, like springs rattling in an old car. So you couldn't help but notice them. You took them in much the same way the piebald horse had started wandering over. The horse was a fat-bellied shadow ambling through the stillness where the light was turning. Nearby, some thistles. The mare and the pony grazed in deep grass. You'd see none of this clearly till later. There was your own looking, walking, to account for. The pigeons, the horse, the crickets, the swamp gums were just there, scarcely visible, secretly communicative in every direction, like a place where paths, meandering, at last meet. Sure, a bird had then cried out, as if the moment could go dark with an utter suddenness. You'd remember that bird as somewhere a cuckoo dove before rain. You'd remember it as a whoop, a shout rather than a call. But you would by then be walking back down the driveway, oblivious to the clay-coloured light, the pale wisps of grass, and the heaped-up blemish of gravel, which marked some ant's nest, living or abandoned. Later you'd say you saw everything. It entered you. Of course, it remains no more than a story about seeing and forgetting. Its narrative is the root of compassion, not least because afterwards you must still capture it at one go. Yes, in a single sharp flame of light, setting and slanting, raking deep far behind the trees, their black silhouettes on the ridge, invisibly burning you, invisibly burning itself.
Yeah, the black silhouettes. The Crooked Men. My dad straightened out the Crooked Men in the old laundry shed. Above the fishing gear and jars of nuts and bolts, where on a rack their naked, twisted forms did hang from the neck. Body hair like pine needles, restrained by welded G-clamps and steel-trapped teeth, hydraulic arms and pulleys, and a shiny drip tray on the floor to catch the expelled, blackened hate. Sometimes 8, sometimes 10, the crooked men with faces like prunes, tattoos and scars, and tongues that could no longer work, but engulfed by obscenities, as they leaked night and day in that old laundry shed. And they were not grateful or ungrateful, the crooked men, nor were they in debt to my father and his amazing rack. In these days when their hate would trickle through my backyard haven, drowning the smells of Saturday afternoon and freshly cut grass, and the yap of the Labrador, and innocence lost to the crooked men.
It's a very strong poem. I know that poem, yeah.
Yeah. That poem, the light in my mind that accompanies that poem is very, very similar to the light in the poem you just read.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
It's The Crooked Men's just about to be made into an animation.
Is it?
Feature, yeah.
We, fantastic.
We just got the green light from the Australian Film Commission.
Fantastic.
Ah, it's been a great morning. How are we doing in there, team?
It's been a great morning for us too, I can assure you. I'll come in.
And in this Poetica podcast from RN, you've been listening to On the Road, Part 2, with Samuel Wagon-Watson and Martin Harrison. The producers were Jane Ullman and Russell Stapleton. In our next podcast, we explore the poetry of silence.